You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
In some sense, I guess we met maybe about a year ago.
It's in fall.
Which seems like ever so very long ago, because we gathered a group of people who were thinking about accessibility from a variety of different perspectives. And Rosemary was clearly the star of the show in bringing a really unique and powerful perspective to our conversations and helping me challenging the Berkman Center to do better on issues of accessibility and access, and to also not just to do better, but to really rethink our ideas about accessibility to technology, to learn from universal design, to learn from some of the other experiences that we've seen in architecture, urban planning, design, and about 25 other disciplines. She comes to us from Emory, where she's a professor of women's studies and English, by way of Radcliffe down the road, where she has been a fellow this past year. But I think has a really powerful perspective on critical, what maybe she calls critical disability studies, or at least that's how I think of it, and being both wonderfully critical, but in a wonderfully constructive way. And I think it's a really important dialogue for us to have and then to continue with, follow the dialogue up with action. And so one of the reasons I'm so thrilled to have all the interns in this room for you is because these are the ones who are going to be making that stuff happen. And so I'm hopeful and confident that you will infect them with your particular fabulous vision, and that you guys will challenge her in ways that shows how much she really has to offer. So please, welcome us.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to make sure this is going. Can you hear all right? Okay, great. Well, welcome, and thank you very much for coming. Colin, thank you for this opportunity and the invitation to be here at the Berkman Center and to share the work that I do in critical disability studies, which we take, of course, the term from critical race studies, or sometimes we call our work cultural disability studies. So I'm here to basically tell you and show you what an accessible world we live in right now at this moment in this place. And I'm going to emphasize the idea of my title here, expanding the concept of accessible technology. I have a lot of images so that I can show and tell at the same time, and I'm going to try to go through them quickly in order to be highly illustrative about the rather simple points that I want to make. This has a hair trigger. So my purpose today is to expand the idea of accessible technology and to show you the way we make our shared world of buildings, of technologies, of public spaces, practices, laws, culture, and attitudes, and how it builds a total environment which welcomes some people and keeps other people out. So the talk is going to present an evolution of how accessible technologies, in the very broadest sense, make our citizenry more inclusive and diverse. So the principle that I'm going to be illustrating to you today is that accessible technology is everywhere once you know how to look for it. Okay, people with disabilities, of course, have always used technology to participate in a world that's not built for them. For most of history, of course, disabled people out in public have been beggars. The figure of the crippled or the blind beggar accessing public space with technology appears often in such well-known artworks as the ones I'm showing you here, the 1525 painting by Peter Bruegel, or this 1916 photograph of a blind beggar by the American photographer Paul Strand. So these are disabled folks using technology to access the public world. Disabled people participate in and contribute to the world by using innovative technologies that bridge the gap between their distinctive ways of being in the world and a material and a social environment that's built for standard bodies. What we sometimes call, and I like this term a lot, majority bodies. The writer and the intellectual Helen Keller, for example, used a human interpreter to facilitate communication. She's a 1908 graduate of Radcliffe, by the way. Whereas the physicist Stephen Hawking uses a machine for communication and mobility. Most technology that human beings use exclude people with disabilities because the designs are either inflexible or only support standard bodies. In our contemporary moment, however, distinctive technologies designed to be used by people with disabilities are emerging from the developed world. For instance, and I hope you're all following this, double amputee Oscar Pistorius uses fiber carbon prosthetic legs made down the road here at MIT to compete against runners with fleshly legs. And he is trying to qualify to run in the Olympics, not the Paralympics, and has till, I think, 3 or 4 days to do it. To suggest the expansion and the evolution of accessible technology, I want to lay out for you today, as I suggested, two opposing kinds of what I call world building. Both are material and historical initiatives that shape communities by determining who and who does not participate in these communities. One of these is eugenic world building. The other is inclusive world building. And I'm going to start with eugenic world building, but I'm going to emphasize inclusive world building. But I want to spend a little bit of time laying out a contrast here so that you have a sense of the logic and the history of what I call eugenic world building. So eugenic world building was a progressive, and this is important, initiative carried out primarily in the first half of the 20th century worldwide, but most fully in the developed West. That's because they had technology. And delivered, that is intended to shape a desired citizenry by producing more of the people that any given group considers valuable and by eliminating the people that are considered to be inferior. So things like better baby contests and fitter family competitions were common practices to define and to show what a desired citizen might be like. These are examples, these better baby contests, of what is sometimes called positive eugenics. Negative eugenics was carried out, of course, at the same time through laws and medical practices in the United States and elsewhere in the developed world through primarily forced sterilization, which happened extensively in the United States. The famous 1927 Supreme Court decision authorized forcible sterilization. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes explained the logic of this negative eugenics policy by asserting quite famously the quote, three generations of imbeciles is enough. Nazi Germany enacted, of course, the ultimate logic of negative eugenics beginning in September 1939 by rounding up and exterminating several hundred thousand disabled Germans who were in institutions that ranged from orphanages to medical care facilities. And they transferred them to extermination facilities where the Nazis, in cooperation with medical practitioners, developed the gas chambers and the sham medical exams, which were later used in the much more ambitious Nazi project to exterminate the Jews of Europe and other groups who were considered to be eugenically inferior. Today, across the developed world, reproductive technologies carry out a kind of negative eugenics aimed at eliminating disability and people born with disabilities under the logic of individual choice. And we might want to think a little bit about the more recent development of the population imbalance that's taking place in developing countries as a result of sex selection abortion, which is in some sense a eugenic undertaking. Princeton philosopher Peter Singer advocates that disabled newborns should be euthanized on the basis of parental discretion. And there's a quote here by Peter Singer. "We think that some infants with severe disabilities should be killed." And he holds to that philosophical position to this day. Now, for a cheerier topic, what I'm calling inclusive world building is a way of thinking which strives to make a world in which a diverse range of human beings can use effectively and participate fully. Inclusive world building is a set of legal and material practices born of the civil and the human rights movements of the mid-20th century that changed the composition of the citizenry who could fully participate in all aspects of civil life. And some of this legislation you are aware of is ensconced in the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 and 2009, as well as the worldwide United Nations Treaty on the Rights of People with Disabilities, which was enacted in 2008. For the rest of my time today, I'm going to present you aspects of inclusive world building developed and enacted as a direct result of the legal and the material initiatives that developed out of the human and civil rights movement. Inclusive design is a guiding principle of world building that has transformed the built environment by allowing a wide diversity of citizens previously excluded to enter into and use the world that we have built together and that we share in order for them to use and to exercise the privileges and the obligations of a democratic citizenship. So, inclusive design. What I'm calling inclusive design is a principle of world making expressed through a variety of terms, some of which you might be familiar with. Inclusive design, design for all, universal design, human-centered design, barrier-free design. One definition that I like to put forward that I've developed is inclusive design is human-centered design of everything with everyone in mind. And I'm going to try to show you some examples. I want to take a moment to call attention to the iconography of inclusive world building as a way to kind of gesture to the varying solutions that human communities have developed to extend the opportunity to previously excluded citizens to participate in civic life. So the international symbol of access, I love this because it's both an icon and a sign as well as a material technology of accessibility that calls attention to the accessible features of the built environment that actually tend to go unnoticed because we routinely use them. So these various icons that I'm going to scroll through fairly quickly become signs in both senses of the world of an accessible environment for us, all of us, to notice and to use collectively. So the sign for wayfinding for people with low vision or anyone who has wayfinding challenges. The sign language interpretation, which I think is a particularly elegant symbol. Volume control telephone symbol here provides accessibility in communication. Of course, family restrooms, which have transformed life for all of us. Single-use restrooms allow a variety of different people, including, and this is really interesting recently, transsexual people to appropriately use restrooms. I like this the best. I call these renegade access symbols that are what I call the crowdsourced iconography of access that has emerged from the bottom up. This is on the left a initiative undertaken by actually someone in the room here to promote a redesigned, more agentic, as it were, symbol of accessibility, and to overlay that on the more static symbol that that has been developed. And then my favorite one, I don't even know where this came from, is it's a directional icon for disabled sex, which is important. Another really quite wonderful sexuality-oriented piece of iconography. Okay, I want to go through a number of images that are illustrative of inclusive world building at work to call your attention to some of these features that we all experience and use oftentimes without realizing that we are accessing technologies that make the world more diverse for all of us. So before I do that, I have a list here as well as some illustrations of the principles of universal design if you wish to take a look at those. They're a little bit hard to understand, but it's worth investigating it later. Equitable use, flexibility in use, simple and intuitive, perceptible information, low tolerance or tolerance for error, low physical effort, size and space. I don't know why the four is in there. Approach and use. I use dictation technology, which has these really funny little ticks, and also some hilarious things. My favorite one is that sometimes when I say to my technology accessible, it comes out E-X-C-E-S-S-I-V-E, new word, B-U-L-L. Excessive bull.
Are you sure that's not it?
That's absolutely. That's exactly right. So the drinking fountain at multiple heights, the push button that allows doors to open for people who use wheelchairs or are carrying lots of packages or children or anything else. So ease of manipulation is important. The universal lever-handled doors instead of the round doorknobs provide universal accessibility to everyone. It's an elegant example, and they're also beautiful. Threshold-free access, long ramps and curb cuts, and you're seeing illustrations, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, of varying kinds of wheeled mobility. We have some elegant designs that have evolved for wheelchair usage, for example, in airports. We're seeing more and more and more people using wheelchairs to navigate the long distances that are required to travel in our mega airports these days. There are also some walkers that are particularly elegant and useful kinds of accessible mobility, accessible technology. Multiple usage wheeled access. I talk a lot about the invention of wheeled luggage, which occurred contemporaneously with the changes in the built environment to ramp it, so that we are able now to have those all-terrain vehicle strollers for parents to be able to access public transportation in spaces that they were kept out of before, as well as wheeled luggage, which is perhaps one of the most universal of all technologies. I like this concept. Accessible sanitary systems. These are particularly elegant design solutions. Architectural elegance, of course, we notice now that the legislation in the U.S. and elsewhere has been underway for about 30 years or more. Architects are beginning to develop some beautiful and elegant solutions besides simply shoving an ugly ramp on the front of an old building. And here are some examples. There's often a conflict between preserving historical integrity and creating access, but architects and designers are beginning to come up with, again, elegant and effective solutions for this. This is a cathedral with a really lovely ramp. Accessible transportation systems, I'd like to focus on a little bit, in the sense that in a democratic capitalist order, one of the most important aspects of this, the world we live in now, is mobility in every sense. And transportation is the key to mobility in every sense. So accessible transportation systems, such as the DC Metro, offer wide variety of access. I love this particular illustration. This is a woman getting on an accessible piece of transportation with her service pony. We have brailled information services in public places and in accessible transportation. Service animals, of course, have access to public transportation. Cane navigation is facilitated by technologies in public transportation and elsewhere. Multiple vertical transportation modes exist in most public transportation: elevators, escalators, stairs, inclined paths. Multiple linguistic access, English language signage, Spanish signage, this is from the Washington, D.C. Metro, symbolic signage, universal signage, and most interestingly, what I call non-literate signage, which we often see. Varied stability aids are very important, and here we have, of course, someone using stability aids in order to have a infant-carrying wheel device on a metro car. Train platform continuities are very important for wheeled access from platform into subway and train cars. I'll talk a little bit more now about accessible communication devices. If I had an hour and a half, I would go on and on about my love affair with the iPhone and the iPad, the newly accessible one, which has changed my life and made it possible for me to do work. I'll talk a little bit more about that. There are apps in the iPhone and the iPad that are universally accessible. You don't have to download them separately. I think many of you know about this. You simply can turn them on for a variety of different access features. There are apps that use amazing kinds of, I don't know, programs. I'm not very good at talking about this, that, for example, allow people to communicate using sign language with FaceTime. Or there are some really interesting apps. I don't know, again, how to use that. This is a picture of a woman with low vision or blind who is using her iPhone to take pictures of cans in her cupboard, and then somehow it goes somewhere, and somehow something tells her what's... There you go. What's in her cupboard? Simple things, of course, like varying size text, enlargeable text. We know and use these features often. This is a picture of me using the iPhone and the iPad technology, which works really well for me. I don't have a very iconic disability. I have a rather distinctive disability. Therefore, I have particular needs, and the iPhone has made it possible for me to text in a way that I couldn't possibly do before, and has made communicating and creating text extremely accessible for me so that I can do my work and be out and about in the world. Okay, the last thing that I want to talk about is perhaps most the most counterintuitive and distinctive aspect of accessible technology, and that is what I call art and culture as a form of accessible technology. So the entry of people with disabilities, of course, and other people that have been excluded previously on the basis of categories such as race and gender has given them access to social capital such as education, employment, acculturation, and social networks, which has produced a flourishing disability culture in which accessible technology is a crucial component. And I'm going to try to show you how accessible technology is implicated and fundamental to producing disability art and culture. Okay, More recent popular television shows such as Glee introduced accessible technologies and people with disabilities to add both hip diversity and cheerful theatricality to the plots. So we have wheelchairs and actual people with disabilities in such television shows as Glee. Civil rights lawyer and author Harriet McBride Johnson has engaged that philosopher Peter Singer into a public debate in the New York Times about his advocacy for euthanizing disabled newborns. So not only medical and mechanical technology provided access to education and economic resources for people like Harriet McBride Johnson, but communication technologies put Johnson and her ideas before a wide general public. The photographer, Kevin Conley, who was born legless and travels the world on a low-riding kind of skateboard that he prefers over a wheelchair for mobility, has reversed the photographic gaze that's established by artists such as Diane Arbus by photographing thousands of people across the world that he has captured looking at him. The distinctive angle of his camera and the surprise that he captures on the faces and the postures of the people looking at him turns back their looks upon them and reveals their surprise at encountering such an unusual person out and about in the world using the accessible world and accessible technology. You can go to his website and see his 3,000 photographs. The entry of disabled people into the world and the media has produced a cadre, I love this part, of disabled celebrities whose stories and images range much beyond earlier disabled celebrities such as Helen Keller or even Stephen Hawking. One example is the fashion model, actress, champion runner, and TED lecturer, Amy Mullins. With fashion model good looks and a shape that's very Barbie-esque, Mullins is also a double amputee, and she quips that disability is a great advantage as a fashion model because she can make herself as tall as she wants to be. And she has a wide variety of prosthetic and functional and cosmetic legs that she uses and proudly displays in all kinds of public performances of disability and femininity and accessibility in the world. The blind author, Georgina Klieg, has a series of really wonderful books that I would highly recommend. She's written a book called Sight Unseen, which investigates the metaphorics of sight and blindness in the world. And she has a wonderful epistolary set of personal essays called Blind Rage. It's one of the best titles ever. Letters to Helen Keller. I think the most radical development and implementation of accessible technology has emerged in disability visual art, or disability art in general. The subjects of the portraits that I'm presenting here have been traditionally characterized as people with disease, deformity, disfigurement. And I'd suggest, however, that these kinds of paintings begin to show us how we might reimagine disability through aesthetic accessible technologies, not as a form of inferiority that we want to eliminate from the human condition, but rather perhaps a form of rare beauty. This is one of Harriet McBride Johnson's terms that I think is really important and interesting and out there as a kind of form of aesthetic accessible technology that I'll talk about a little bit in the remainder of my time here. Disability aesthetics, I want to suggest, is a form of accessible technology that enables us to understand embodiment and subjectivity in new ways. Art, photography, and painting has captured some of the ways that this rare beauty can be found in disability. It's a beauty, I suggest, that emerges from distinctiveness rather than ordinariness, from struggle rather than comfort, and from the unusual rather than the usual. This is a photograph, a fashion shoot by the English photographer Nick Knight, and the late designer, English designer, Alexander McQueen, who designed a series of costumes and a photo shoot called Accessible. This is also a photograph on the right of the model and the dancer, Catherine Long, who was born partially armless. And it's a really interesting sculptural posture in which her shoulder, her disarmed shoulder, if we want to call it that, is extended up, and her arm is hanging down in a really beautiful sculptural pose. The entry of disability into contemporary dance is one of the most vibrant stories of how accessible technology can facilitate an evolution of artistic form. The introduction of the wheelchair into dance, it has been suggested, I love this, is the most important innovation in contemporary dance since the toe shoe in ballet. So I'm going to show you, So one of the most interesting and controversial uses of accessible technology in theatrical artistic production comes from none other than Lady Gaga, who uses disability technology such as wheelchairs, crutches, and eye patches as a kind of sensationalist fashion set of accessories and costuming in her music videos and in her live performances. In July 2011, Lady Gaga rolled out for a performance in Sydney using a wheelchair in a sensationalist performance of what I call disability drag. In my view, the cultural work of using accessible technology associated with disabled people, let's see if this works. How do I get the mouse? I mean, how do I get the cursor there?
Someone else?
Oh, okay, thank you. I'll do it. Okay, we're going to see.
Shot!
Somebody drag. So Lady Gaga's getting out of a limousine.
We're on the crowd. We'd be so fantastic. Leather and jeans, the right glamorous. Not sure what it means, but this photo of us, it don't have a price. Ready for those flashing lights, cause you know that baby I'm your latest fan. I'm proud of you.
Outfit. What I want to suggest, of course, is that to use disability technologies as a form of theatrical costuming moves what we thought of as medicalized disability prostheses out of the world of medical stigmatization into the world of high fashion and celebrity, which I think does some pretty interesting cultural work. So I'm going to finish with a clip here. This is disabled dancer Bill Shannon, who goes by the stage name Crutchman. He has evolved a new dance form and set of choreographic moves using crutches that he requires, this is important, for mobility, to fashion them with a kind of rocker bottom. So this is a very distinctive kind of technology that he himself developed, accessible technology, in order to develop new breakdancing moves. Moreover, and I think this is really important, we can talk about this if it's of interest to you, Shannon's dancing is so compelling to have been used in a mainstream advertisement for Visa credit cards. This is the entirety of the ad. So Shannon's sitting on a bench. He's gets up, grabs his crutches, and breakdances down the street. Flies down the banister. Now, without being an apologist for consumer capitalism, I'd like to leave you with a thought, and that is the difference between the 1525 cripples of Peter Bruegel, whose only access to economic resources was begging in the public sphere, and Bill Shannon, who through accessible technology, an accessible world, and access to the kinds of resources, social capital that he needed, actually has a job. Thank you. So I think we have maybe up to 30 minutes for questions.
About half an hour. So people should fearlessly dive in. Lots to chew on.
I'm happy to field any questions or comments that you have. Please.
Just a brief thing. I was wondering, when you were talking about the different pictures of architecture that have accessibility sort of built into them, there's a particular image I saw of a set of stairs that have actually like a wheelchair ramp being sort of the main focus of the stairs, and the rest of the height of the ramp is made up of stairs that go around the ramp. And I just wondered if you knew that picture, because it seemed to me to be a sort of impactful photograph, and that it demonstrated the way that able-bodied technology could be built around accessible technology instead of having accessibility sort of built in as an afterthought.
Yes, I'm not an architect or a designer, so some of who are involved in that might be able to explain it a little bit more. But as I understand it, universal design as a principle, a set of principles, would put forward the concept that there should be, or that there might be one form of access that is universal to all, rather than multiple modes of access for different kinds of access. And I think those two ideas are a little bit in tension, and they are carried out in different ways by different designers and different architects in making the built environment. I think it's actually quite interesting to see multiple modes of access, which would be the kind of thing you're suggesting, a ramp next to stairs, because it provides multiple solutions and it provides people with alternatives. For example, ramps are not always the most beneficial or the most efficient ways for all people to access a change of a vertical, what is it called? Vertical, I don't know, change of height, that's not right, but going up for a bunch of different reasons. And so I think personally that multiple design solutions to provide multiple forms of access, that's certainly what public transportation does. So we have elevators, we have escalators, we have ramps, varying ways of accessing a change of level. So thank you. Other comments, questions, arguments?
I had a question. It was really interesting bringing up Lady Gaga and Glee, and your disability drag was a fantastic phrase I hadn't heard before. And I agree your point about how it kind of makes it more, brings it, more people make practical and high fashion. But I was wondering if what your thoughts were in terms of, like, even in Glee, in one episode, he gets up and walks, right? And even in the video you just showed, you know, first Lady Gaga had to be picked up by, you know, helpers, and then later she's getting up and walking.
Or got to be.
Right, fair, fair. But in a lot of these, even in media, you see somebody who is in disability drag, then later casting that off and this miraculous recovery almost. And I was wondering if that might give, like, the wrong impression to some people who may not be as familiar with minority bodies, as you say, that, oh, it's this choice that they're in a wheelchair, this choice they're using this technology. Even the fashion model, you know, talks about the great things about it, which is cool in terms of she can change all of her legs, but at the same time, she doesn't have the choice to have fleshlights. Yeah, so I was just curious what your thoughts were on that.
No, that's a really good question. And, of course, I am telling a very particular kind of story. There's much controversy, as there always is in, you know, sort of democratic public conversation about authenticity within disability and also about varying stereotypes of disability, such as the concept of overcoming one's disability, the idea of cure, the idea of, of who ought and ought not to be using these varying kinds of technologies, which is, again, a kind of question of authorship and authority all the way around. I think that those are really vibrant and important conversations. I was just at a conference and someone gave a paper on Lady Gaga, and of course there's a lot of condemnation and a lot of understanding, or there's an argument that would say that it's a trivializing of disability by someone who doesn't need to use a wheelchair using it. I support, as I'm sure you're able to see, a kind of universalizing. For example, we've already done that with the accessible technology of glasses. Mm-hmm. You know, all you need to do is look at the New York Times for 1 second and you see what's happened there. But, of course, that's also creating a market for accessible technology. But I think making technology inclusive and available to everyone is a really important democratic step so that, for one thing, disability status is the most porous of all of the social categories. We say often that if anyone who lives long enough will become disabled eventually. And so in some ways, being able to imagine big glasses or wheelchair use or canes or even hearing aids as fashion accessories early on in life or at times in life when one is able to occupy non-disabled status, I think is good practice. I just met a woman at a conference who has who's hard of hearing and has been her whole life, and she had been using the kinds of hearing aids that have been developed. She uses one hearing aid in each ear that had been developed for kind of stealth hearing aids, in other words, that would look the very most inconspicuous. And she said she finally decided to get her hair cut off short, because she always had her hair long to cover up her hearing aids. She got her hair cut short in this really hip hairdo, and she got hearing aids. Well, she doesn't call them hearing aids. There's another word for them now, inserts, I think, or something like that, that fills in the inside of her whole ear that are purple. And I said to her, you ought to get rhinestones in them next. And her purpose is twofold. I think this is really interesting. One is it's a disclosure method so that she announces her status as hard of hearing so that people are able to, hearing people are able to be in better communication with her. They're better able to understand who it is that they're dealing with and what kinds of interactions are going to ensue from this. And also it's a bit of a disability pride thing, and it looks cool. Plus her son has the same hearing loss that she has, and, you know, he's got blue ones. And she wanted to be able to say, you know, here are mommies, they're purple, what color do you want? And, you know, he has some that are red, white, and blue, and a variety of different ones, sort of fashion, you know, hearing aids. And that comes out of a disability pride movement that would not have even been possible 30 years ago. And her life works better that way. not because she hears better with the technology, but because it's a technology that does other kinds of things. It announces itself. Please.
Quick comment just about what you were just saying. During one of the NBA playoff games, in the interview afterwards, Dwayne Wade was wearing a pair of fake glasses, no lenses, because he doesn't have a visual problem, but he was wearing it as a style statement. And I looked online shortly thereafter, and there was a bunch of some comics that people had made, about that, sort of urging celebrities to start wearing fake hearing aids, hipster hearing aids, they were calling them.
Hipster hearing aids. And, that's fabulous. Thank you.
And so I did have a question about creating inclusive design, not as much in the physical space, but on the internet, and what your thoughts were about that, particularly, in things like streaming video for people with hearing issues. That's been a really big issue and struggle in order to get companies to put captioning. And so what your thoughts were on some principles that would be, good in the online space, and perhaps what you thought the role of, statute and law and court cases would be in that.
Well, I can't say a lot about that, court cases and law, but you could talk to Michael Stein over here in the Harvard Law School, who has the Disability Law Project, I think it's called, or Disability and Law Project, and that's what he does. As I suggested, of course, it is legislation that has rendered the desegregation of people with disabilities, along with the desegregation of women and people of color in the world. One of the main differences, and this is what I wanted to bring forward, is that there's a distinct materiality to that desegregation in terms of disability access that is somewhat different from the integration of women and people of color into public space in the democratic order since the civil rights movement. And, of course, it's interesting that these civil rights movements took place in the United States and elsewhere, but certainly in the United States, contemporaneously. They all began more or less from the very late 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. We know about this, what Harvard was gender desegregated in the early 1970s. That's just one example. And the disability rights movement, which, interestingly enough, I didn't even know about until, I was well into adulthood, because it didn't have as much play, took place at the same time. But it was carried out through these monumentally important pieces of legislation, just as gay marriage is being carried out, or equality in marriage, pardon me, is being carried out in through the legal arena. Those decisions have been made. And that has transformed the world. So technology, of course, needs to be accessible also, and it doesn't have the same kind of materiality. But there are guidelines and standards for accessible technology. There's something, somebody will have to help me out here, called Bobby, which is a system of vetting and approval that you can get if you're making a website that's Bobby approved, which means that it's accessible for example, people using screen readers. That's one of the main things.
There's also standards from W2C.
And, right. There's a lot being done about accessible, the standards and protocols for accessible technology. Another really interesting development is Universal Design and Learning, UDL, which is a set of principles and pedagogical strategies that have produced recommendations for multiple access to learning that are fairly easily implemented, in the same way that we argue that curb cuts are really easily implemented if they're built in instead of bolted on and inexpensive. That same sort of theory is behind Universal Design and Learning. So you can just look at UDL and see a billion sample syllabi and pedagogical strategies, please.
Thanks for the talk. I was wondering if you would talk a little bit to kind of the critiques around universal design. I know that there's some challenge to the idea, particularly for those who are in a marginalized group, saying that universal design can really downplay their concerns of not being in the mainstream, and that it can be a very mainstreaming force that says that these structural issues are perhaps less important. And while it helps to accommodate them more in the mainstream, it kind of can highlight the question of who has the right to have their interests reflected in building worlds or in building technologies. Is it just the mainstream, or do people who can't fit into the mainstream have a right to also have their worlds built for them too? So I'm wondering.
Well, it sounds like you know a lot about this, actually.
I'm wondering if you could link it to technology as your...
Well, I'm obviously using technology in its very broadest sense, and my purpose there is to try to suggest a broad understanding of technology as being anything that allows a kind of, a tool would be one way of thinking about technology, but even that, I think, can be somewhat limited, but some kind of a material thing that lies between our fleshly embodiment and the environment that we live in and that we have to operate in. So that kind of a definition would say that clothes are a form of technology, that tools are a form of technology, language is a form of technology. I mean, we kind of know this. But the accessible technology that allows a wide range of people to use the world that was not built originally for them is, and I suggested this, but I think it's important, it itself, in the sense that because we use it so comfortably, because the interface, as it were, between the body and the world that allows us to do tasks and to be out in the world is so smooth that it isn't often even noticed. And that's one reason I wanted to bring forward all these varying kinds of technologies. That's one reason I'd like to see Lady Gaga and anybody else who wants to use cute wheelchairs or feather-encrusted hearing aids does so that there's the widest distribution and use of technology. And, of course, one of the principles of technology is that it has unintended usages. For example, I'm not exactly answering your question, but maybe I am. For example, the history of the Washington Metro being built, which I mentioned briefly and gave you some examples, is particularly interesting and emblematic. First of all, the Washington Metro, they dug a hole to build it in the 1970s. So it began being built at exactly the same time that the legislation for an accessible world started being put forward. So the Architectural Barriers Act was in 1968. That was the year that the Washington Metro got started. So it grew up and got built as a material thing while the legislation and practices were developing. And so it's exemplary in that sense, as opposed to a kind of retrofitted public transportation system, or one that was built much later after a lot of the design solutions and court cases, I might add, had been worked out. So, of course, the first thing was that to make the Washington Metro accessible, they said, we got to have they, meaning the advisors that I think largely came from the disability community and advocates for disability access, said, you got to have elevators. And, of course, they said, are you kidding? We got to, elevators cost too much. So how about just escalators? And the argument went, no, you got to have elevators because a lot of people can't really use escalators very effectively. I'm not sure quite what the examples are, but say, I might have this a little bit wrong, but sometimes cane users, escalators don't work real well. Certainly, you can't take a motorized wheelchair on an escalator either. So they said, okay, how about to save money and not build these elevators, let's have a special van service. You can call up and you can have a van come and pick you up and take you to an accessible station or take you where you need to go. And a judge ruled that that was separate but equal and that it was not allowable and ordered them to build the elevators. And now, of course, we understand the argument would be, why build the elevators? There are only one or two people that are ever going to use them. So this, we know this principle about sort of unintended users or surprising consequences, like rolling suitcases, for one thing. So that stands as a particularly important example of how people, groups that may not be understand themselves as being in the mainstream can actually use accessible technology in ways that the designers had not ever imagined. I had my most satisfying moment the other day. I don't know if anyone follows George Will, who, as you know, is a conservative pundit. Thank you. A conservative pundit. But George Will also has a son who has Down syndrome. And he's written really, I think, important things about the rights of inclusion and the rights of people with disabilities. And his son turned 50 the other day, and he wrote a series of articles, or a couple of articles, columns about this. And I couldn't believe my good luck, because I keep making the argument that the Washington, D.C. Metro is fully accessible to a wider range of people than was ever intended. And he talked about his son going to baseball games and fishing and using the metro, and that he knows how to use the metro by himself, which means that the metro is an accessible space for transportation. We can make the argument that it's an accessible space of transportation for people with developmental disabilities. And so I was really glad to hear that. Question?
France, they've had a widespread implementation of a new icon that looks like a friendly face, basically, which is targeted for cognitive but also psychosocial disabilities, which are, of course, more difficult to generalize about and support and so on. And so, and it's not legible to everybody. I mean, I've seen some commentary on the web, like, what does this mean? It's like a drama mask.
Like a little smiley face? I haven't seen this at all.
Yeah,
I've been traveling.
Yeah, it's like a sort of friendly face idea. So, and then I think it's an interesting provocation for the digital space, because
is it to indicate something else, or is it to be to create a kind of affective environment right there?
I think that it's the latter. So I think that it's to indicate, like, if you're someone who has an anxiety disorder, or you're someone who is overwhelmed by a certain kind of noise or the options in a space, in a very bureaucratic space or something, and you need, you know, some minimum of support or something, you know, more involved, like we're sort of aware and you can approach us and say, you know, I need some. So I do think for the digital space, again, there, the kind of suppleness of that kind of move, where you sort of offer, you know, a helping hand, but you haven't sort of decided what that is.
It's kind of a new way of imagining assistance, I guess.
That's right, yeah.
Or even what we might think of as customer service.
Temporary disability and so on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's very interesting. I'll look that up. Thank you. Please.
Hi. I really love this idea of rare beauty.
Thank you.
That's great. I wanted to explore a little bit more and see where the edge was between something that's beautiful and seeing something that's other and freakish, and where you see that line and looking at these objects.
Well, there's a lot that has been thought and written about and created that challenges, let's say, traditional notions of aesthetics, both in art and, of course, in, I don't know, what might be called, you know, feminist appearance conversations.
She's so good with that.
But in relation to some of this art, and also in particular in relation to art that is sometimes considered sensationalist or grotesque or surrealism, which are aesthetic movements or aesthetic categories that actually feature what we think of as disability. I mean, surrealism is about extravagant disability. There's also quite a bit of interesting work that's been done around, as I said, the grotesque, which is a literary and aesthetic category of hybridity. I was just at a conference in Edinburgh giving a keynote address, and the name of the, talk about sensationalists, the name of the conference was Sensualizing Deformity. It was terrific, because, of course, what they were doing was trying to figure out the connections between the fantastic and surreal representation of, let's say, otherness, and the political agendas involved in disability rights and inclusion. And they did a really interesting job, but there's some fabulous art. I'll tell you one of the most interesting things, I didn't include this here, that I've discovered recently. If you want an example of this kind of thing, there is a British artist who works in the medium of photography named Alexa Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, and she has a lot of series, but this one series that she's done called After Image is really fascinating, and I've been trying to do some work around it. She has made portraits, and I'm very interested in portraits of people with disabilities, as some of the pictures I've suggested have, or I've shown have suggested. She did a series of photographic portraits of, I think, 6 or 7 people with phantom limb. And they described, you may know what phantom limb is, it's the neurological experience of an amputated body part, hence phantom limb, it's a really wonderful term. Anyway, she talked to people with phantom limb, amputees obviously with phantom limb, and asked them what their experience of this phantom limb was like. And then she digitally created that experience in the photographs. So, for example, there's a picture that I often show of a woman seated in a chair, and one arm looks a little bit like this arm, and the other one looks a little bit like this arm, except that there's a gap between the wrist and the elbow, because that's how this woman experiences, in terms of sensation, her own body. So it's really quite fascinating to see that, and it's one of the few places that I have seen the subjective experience of disability represented visually. So it's really interesting stuff. So these kinds of things are being discussed all the time. There was a really interesting sculpture up in Trafalgar Square that you might have got a look at. I think it came down about a year or so ago because it was a public art that's rotating of a sculpture called Alison Lapper Pregnant, done by Mark Quinn, who's a very well-known British artist. And he made this white marble nude statue of a nude woman on a pedestal, except that she's rather significantly disabled. She has very foreshortened arms and legs, and she's pregnant. So it was an extremely controversial content in an extremely conventional form, and operated as a forum for a lot of interesting public discussions about what we ought to be looking at, who ought to be out in public, who ought to be having reproducing, who ought not to be. So it was a very provocative, in every sense, piece of public art where disability was doing something in the world to get some good conversations up in a democratic order.
What your thoughts are with respect to financial access to disability technology and the impact of potentially mainstreaming disability technology having on potentially technology that's necessary for people who may be more marginalized or wouldn't fit within that mold. I personally have known people not to get hearing aids because they don't feel they can afford it, which is more simple, probably less expensive technology, and then you're talking about, I mean, we've seen some very elegant prosthesis and things like that, but my understanding, not having any experience myself, is that that is not necessarily accessible to most, and if we're trying to create a more accessible world, a more universally accessible world, how all that plays together, both whether commoditizing it makes it more accessible or not, so that it's accessible through health insurance and things like that.
Well, this is a very important question. Of course, it has to do with the allocation of resources. And those things are historically and geographically quite specific. I mean, California, for example, as you all know, is about financially to sink in the ocean. And so what the first thing that tends to happen is that services for people with disabilities get cut. And there's also a kind of hierarchy of of deservedness that operates perhaps not intentionally but functionally. For example, we tend to think that categories like disabled veterans sort of deserve better services and accommodations than, say, people who have disabilities that involve volition, like addiction. So it's very complicated in that sense. And as I said, I'm telling a very positive story. My own sense is that the more universal technology becomes, the cheaper it's going to become, the more available it's going to become. But there will never be a universal solution to every particular accommodation need. So while I don't even know how Amy Mullins gets her legs or Oscar Pistorius or how much they cost, but they're really kind of prototypes. And we know, those of us who know anything about technology, that the prototype always is expensive and exclusive, and that the more universalized any kind of piece of technology becomes, the cheaper and more accessible it becomes. Here's one example, in my view, is that we are developing sort of better and better and cheaper, but also in some ways more and more expensive forms of addressing, say, hard of hearing and deafness, like cochlear implants, which are medicalized as opposed to a piece of technology that you just sort of stick on, are extremely important. What I'd like to see is an alternative, less technological, lower tech, and less medicalized solution to the universal experience of hearing loss. And anyone with a grandparent knows what I'm talking about here. And that is, and this would be really inexpensive, frankly, is to start teaching sign language in all schools as part of the mandatory curriculum from kindergarten forward, so that all people universally would have some use and knowledge to one degree or another of sign language, so that when people transition into the inevitable hearing, hard of hearing status that they will, that they can simply understand themselves as moving from one form of communication, if they haven't always been deaf or hard of hearing, into another form of communication. Rather than relying on expensive technology, again, anyone with grandparents also knows that has seen this scene of granddad taking that hearing aid out of his ear and either throwing it across the room or flushing it down the toilet, because it doesn't do what we would expect it to do. Part of the narrative of that is that it restores recognizable hearing the way it was, and of course it doesn't. And so in that sense, that's part of the limitation of technology. So if we all use sign language, as the anthropologist, medical anthropologist Nora Gross observed when she studied deafness on Martha's Vineyard in the 19th century, if we all use sign language, deafness as a disability would disappear. So that's one way of addressing access without relying on expensive produced technology. That said, I want everyone to have an iPhone with dictation on it.
Yes, yeah, I do. And it's interesting because thinking about the whole notion of using insurance to purchase and or perhaps not having available insurance to purchase these items, I know a young woman who uses a communication device because she's nonverbal, and it's very expensive, it's very heavy, difficult to use, got an iPad. You could buy 6 iPads for the price of this communication device.
That's interesting.
But the insurance company won't pay for the iPad because it's not used just for communication. Mm-hmm. Because it has other uses.
But that's a glitch right now, but I think that's the kind of answer that we want.
Right.
So that's what universal accessibility is basically about.
But it's not just the creation of the device, because we have the device, then it's the infrastructure around that and accessibility for individuals. To look at this differently.
And
that seems an interesting parallel to technology, where we're accustomed to, as opposed to a purpose-built solution for a narrow thing, like in information communication technology, we'll go for something that's off the shelf and used massively, adjust or make sacrifices for it, but we know the cost is going to be lower, support's going to be better, it's going to be more widely used. Can I pile onto this with just one small question? Which is, so I feel like you make the point very well about the sort of the benefits of universal design, sort of the inclusion of these communities as a way that we're all going to benefit. And you make kind of the point through the art of the power of inclusiveness in terms of getting people out of the house or out into the public and sharing their unique perspective. And I wonder also, to Dahlia's point, whether how far the economic argument of sort of diversity and inclusiveness and getting all of these other communities, which would otherwise often be excluded from the from various workplaces, into the marketplace of ideas, goes against this argument. Whether it's, hey, it's not about, you know, ethical inclusion. It's about, this is about money. We're generating jobs. We're creating livelihoods, and we're adding in kind of a capacity for innovation that we otherwise would not have.
Oh, that's exactly right. In a democratic order,
we should strive to have everyone included in these public spaces in order to exercise the obligations and the rights of citizenship. And one of the rights of citizenship is employment and access to education. And then one of the obligations of citizenship is contribution in some way. And it's much better to have people in the workforce than not. So, which is not to say that we should do away with Social Security and services for people with disabilities. I mean, it's a complicated world. But I think that's exactly what we're after. And the only way that it can occur is through a built environment that is accessible. I mean, that a disabled person can be in this room is kind of the first thing. With that, I'd be happy if anyone has other questions or comments to stick around for a few minutes.
So
thank
you. Please join me.